This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to late 30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. Thank you to Earth Matters for another fantastic show. Made me cry a little bit. It was with the news that the Queensland government is being forced to live up to the legislation that they passed.
Doing something that they should be doing.
Indeed.
Good on them.
Well done.
Yeah, thank you, Earth Matters.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is the 25th of February, believe it or not.
Pushing through February, aren't
we? Yeah. It was a fairly cool, chilly morning today. And it's not going to get too hot today. I think it's a top of 22, 24, something like that.
Most I saw, 21, 22,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit of a change this morning.
Yeah, quite nice. I mean, the rain has been lovely, if rather dramatic yesterday.
That's a good way of putting it. Oh, yeah, that is a good. I was fortunate. I was near home in St Kilda inside when it all came crashing down the way it did. It's pretty dramatic. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my garden's much happier for it.
As is mine.
Yes.
It's interesting too. I think carry on a bit on the. Some news outlets about the although I actually think it possibly was a bit heavier out in the eastern suburbs from what I hear. So maybe that got a little more dramatic out there. But
so hope you all stayed safe through that downpour.
Yes, and you're with myself, Marty, and
with Sonia.
Yeah, it's great to be with you on this very fresh morning.
So on the show today, first up, we have Lee Naunton from Beyond Gas talking to us about an action that they did yesterday to ask some questions, obviously very politely, about carbon capture and storage technology. So we'll have a little chat about that. Then we're going to be...
We'll hear a pre-recorded interview or a very recent recorded interview from Doing Time this week, which is when Marissa spoke with Katie Kiss from Central Queensland. And that interview, a very good one, about social justice, with Social Justice Commissioner Katie Kiss and the Human Rights Commission, where they discussed the establishment of a National Commission for First Peoples Children. And now we have two parts to that. We will certainly hear one, and given if we do have the time, and I expect we will, we'll hear part two of that as well, a little later this morning.
And in between those two parts, we'll be talking to Tom Sulston from Digital Rights Watch. They've just been doing some research into the way in which we've learned lots of valuable lessons from RoboDebt, or rather how we haven't learnt anything at all from the issues that RoboDebt threw up, and how government seems intent on making the same mistakes again.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You would have thought there would be a lot of lessons already learnt out of that.
But seeing as the same people are often in charge of these things, it's not that much of a surprise.
Good point. Later in the show, we're actually going to hear from one of our 3CR colleagues, Amy. We're going to give Amy a call. Amy from Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. I love that.
I love that show.
And that's really interesting. We're going to be talking to Amy about Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day, which takes place next month, early next month on March the 5th.
I think you mean next week.
I do mean next week. Yeah, we're both correct on that one.
We are indeed.
Right, next week. Actually, speaking of time flying by, we were actually talking about birthdays just before we jumped on air too. Mm. So happy birthday to my mum from the weekend.
And we'll go to my mum as well.
To your mum. And happy birthday to anyone who's having a birthday today. Let's do some news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, who?
It's just after 5 minutes past seven on 3CR. You're with Marty and Sonia. Great to have you tuning in this morning. These are our news headlines for today, Wednesday, the February the 25th. And Israeli forces have detained more than 100 Palestinians from the occupied West Bank since the start of Ramadan, including women, children and former detainees, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Since February 18, Israeli military increased the tempo of detentions at the start of Ramadan in most West Bank governorates, including Jerusalem, where Israel also banned Ramadan decorations and restricted various other traditional ways of celebrating the Islamic holy month. Israeli authorities barred thousands of Palestinian worshippers from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Thank you, in occupied East Jerusalem to perform the first Friday prayer of Ramadan, despite them holding previously issued permits. According to the rights group, more than 9,300 Palestinians are currently held in Israeli prisons, including 350 children. The organisation said that thousands of prisoners have been subjected to a policy of starvation for nearly 2.5 years since the beginning of genocide in Gaza, with prison authorities providing barely enough rations to keep them alive. Palestinian and Israeli human rights organisations warn that dozens of detainees died as a result of torture, starvation and medical neglect, and that is according to a Middle East Eye report. At least 1,117 Palestinians have been killed and around 11,500 others injured in attacks by the army and illegal settlers in the West Bank since October 2023. Meanwhile, US Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee contradicted decades of US policy by claiming the Area C of the occupied West Bank is part of Israel in a very recent interview with US podcaster Tucker Carlson. Huckabee's claim on the occupied West Bank was overshadowed by an even more expansive vision for Israel that he shared, saying he would be fine if Israel took over a large swathe of the Middle East, including Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt. The West Bank was carved into areas A, B, and C during the 1990s Oslo peace process, which established the Palestinian Authority out of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Area C comprises roughly 60% of the occupied West Bank, and over the last 20 years, Israeli settlements have mushroomed in Area C. Israeli authorities and settler groups have treated Area C as being under Israel's permanent control. Roughly 400,000 Israeli settlers live in Area C, where they enjoy access to services and political representation that Palestinians are deprived of, creating what critics say is an apartheid state. Israel is also stepping up control over areas A and B. In February, the government approved a plan for Israel to make and enforce decisions on civilian matters in areas A and B, directly undermining Palestinian Authority control.
Co-chair of the First People's Assembly of Victoria, Ngara Murray, will not seek re-election in this year's treaty elections, ending a 3-year tenure during which she helped to oversee the signing of Australia's first treaty. The Wamba Wamba, Yorta Yorta, Jajawurrung and Dodoro woman said she was stepping down as the Assembly enters a new and historic chapter in the journey of First Peoples and the broader Victorian community. Serving as co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria has been one of the greatest honours of my life, and advancing the first treaty in Australia is a responsibility I will always carry with deep humility and pride, she said. Ms. Murray served on both the inaugural Assembly and the second term, the latter as co-chair alongside Gooditjmara man Ruben Berg. She said she was grateful for the trust our people placed in me, and that when they began, we carried a vision that many said was impossible. Today, that vision stands as a reality, with the first treaty in Australia signed, she said, arguing treaty would enable communities with local knowledge to come up with and deliver solutions for our communities. This means we can get better outcomes because Aboriginal people know what does and doesn't work for us. The Assembly is now preparing for its third election, running from March 21st to April 12th, to choose 34 members across general and reserved seats. Alongside a permanent truth-telling body and an accountability commission, the Assembly will oversee policies aimed at closing the gap in Victoria.
And Venezuela's Foreign Minister Iván Gil has demanded the immediate release of the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, who was abducted last month in a violent raid orchestrated by the United States. Addressing the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva this week, Gil demanded Maduro's immediate release by the US government alongside his wife, Celia Flores. Maduro and Flores have been in prison now in New York since the January 3 operation, awaiting trial on drug trafficking and so-called conspiracy to commit narco-terrorism charges. Despite the whirlwind operation, relative calm has prevailed in Venezuela since, while fault lines in the country's leadership remain active under the helm of interim president Delcy Rodriguez. Rodriguez has shifted from early defiance to a more conciliatory tone towards the administration of US President Donald Trump, in contrast to Gil, who has levelled harsher condemnations of US actions. Addressing the UN Council, Gil said the US operation, which he called a systemic campaign, resulted in more than 100 deaths. He described Maduro's abduction as a political operation disguised as a legal debate. Despite the events of early January, however, the foreign minister stated that Venezuela is not in a state of war with the country that he said has been attacking it for the past decade, noting the US blockade and sanctions imposed on Venezuela for years were in full view of the world.
And finally, Mexico remains on high alert after a wave of reprisal attacks triggered by the killings of its most wanted drug cartel leader, even as President Claudia Sheinbaum claimed the country is at peace and life is returning to normal. Some 10,000 soldiers have been deployed across 20 of Mexico's 32 states to maintain order following the killing of Nemesio El Mencho Ozaguirre in a military operation about 130 kilometres from Guadalajara City on Sunday. Guadalajara is the capital of western Mexico's Jalisco state, apologies for mangling language, the stronghold of Oseguara's Jalisco New Generation cartel, where at least 2,000 soldiers have been sent. Schools in Guadalajara and several other Mexican cities were closed on Monday. Security Minister Omar Garcia Harfuch said at least 74 people were killed, including 25 National Guard officers, in the operation that killed the cartel boss and the subsequent violence over the killing of the 59-year-old drug kingpin, one of the most wanted men in Mexico and the United States. According to an Al Jazeera report, El Mencho was considered the last of the drug lords who acted in the brutal mould of the now-imprisoned Joaquin El Chapo Guzman and Ismael El Mayo Zambada of the rival Sinaloa cartel. Following his killing, suspected CJNG members set fire to cars in several states and blocked numerous roads. They also attacked banks, petrol stations and shops. Al Jazeera's John Holman, reporting from Mexico City, said there was an eerie quiet in the country following El Mencho's killing. Many businesses are closed and the trucks that the CJNG cartel dragged across roads to stop Mexican security forces and create chaos have been moved out the way, Holman said. Meanwhile, President Sheinbaum said on Monday that peace had returned to the country. Mexico is calm. We woke up without any roadblocks and all activity has been restored, she said. And those are the headlines for this Wednesday, February the 25th.
We jail black males in Australia nationally at a rate five times greater than apartheid South Africa jailed black males in 1993. The suicide and self-harm rates are the highest in the world, and the life expectancy gap is the biggest in the first world. You know, Australians don't like hearing the truth about how bad things are, but the more we resolve from it, the longer this is going to continue.
Black fella, white fella, it doesn't matter what you colour.
Mainstream media is not interested in this stuff. It doesn't find space to talk truthfully and deeply about issues that affect all Australians. The only place predominantly you will find that with any real depth is on community radio, and 3CR has been one of the great leaders in that. So if people are wondering where they should spend their hard-earned cash, I would suggest 3CR is a bloody good place to start.
What your name is, we got the hair. Lots of changes, we need more brothers.
Welcome back. Just before we go to our first guest this morning, let's have a listen to a track. And this is Fitzroy Crossing with Sweet Home, Home Sweet Home. I do like that one, Sonia. I think I might have said that was Fitzroy Crossing. It's Fitzroy Express are from Fitzroy Crossing, which has currently been experiencing an awful lot of rain. An awful lot of rain up there. Fitzroy Express, they were active in the early 80s. Pretty influential band. And that song, Home Sweet Home.
And now we've got Lee Naunton on the line. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Lee.
You're so welcome,
Sonia. So you were busy this time yesterday. What were you up to?
Well, indeed, it was a conference on carbon capture and storage, aka better described as carbon pollution dumping, at the RECV Club in Melbourne, which is run by an organisation called CO2CRC, which is an organisation set up by governments and the gas companies. Mainly financed by the gas companies, and its raison d'etre is to have an experimental program of sticking carbon dioxide under the ground and under the seafloor. It's been going for about 10 years. Their conference was almost exclusively gas companies, together with an opening address by the Resources Minister, Madeleine King, and Martin Ferguson, an ex-Resources Minister.
My former
the
MP.
Chair of the group, yeah. So we wanted to have a go because our view is that carbon capture and storage, a.k.a. carbon pollution dumping, is a scam.
But it sounds like such a good idea if we can just pull that carbon out where it's causing so much harm out of the air and stick it under the sea. Why wouldn't that work?
Well, yes, it does sound like a good idea, and that is the scammy nature of it, because it most definitely is not. There are several problems with it. The first problem is that it's been going now for about 50 years, and its principal objective across that time, accounting for a bit over 80% of its use, is to actually push residual oil out of the ground. So you drag the carbon dioxide out of the oil you pull out, and then you push it back under the ground again to push out the remaining oil. It's called EOR, Enhanced Oil Recovery, and that's been its major use. And the other bit is to try to capture carbon dioxide from other means and put it under the ground, which is obviously a bit better, but it still has major problems. And one of the major problems is it don't work. Well, it substantially doesn't work. It works
but surely that's how the carbon got there in the first place. It was captured by from the atmosphere and buried under the ground.
Yes, for a very long time, and then it turned into, in this case...
Do you mean that timeline isn't one that would work for us today?
Well, the difficulty is, it's very complicated.
Sounds dangerous just doing it.
Yes, from the point of view of the barbecue test, it's a con job. And the reason it's a con job is that it doesn't work very well. The biggest project in the world to put it back under the seafloor is Gorgon, run by Chevron in Western Australia. Mm-hmm. And it has only managed to stick back under the ground 30% of the carbon dioxide that it uses. And, well, it uses isn't quite the right word because it is carbon dioxide that's in the gas that pulls up. So there's different kinds of gas. What they call sweet gas doesn't have much, and the bath-grade gas is mainly like this, like 2 to 3%. But a lot of the other gas, and particularly the gas off Northern Australia now, has up to 20% of carbon dioxide. So they figure they better do something with that. They used to just like...
So this isn't the carbon dioxide...
Nobody noticed.
Sorry, just... So this isn't the carbon dioxide that's released when the gas is burnt. This is just...
No, which of course... This is the other bit. I shouldn't laugh because it's terrible. This is the other bit of the massive scam. So we in Australia, because of the rules, the international carbon accounting rules set up by the IPCC, we are only responsible in Australia for the carbon dioxide and the methane and other greenhouse gases that we stuff up. We're not responsible for any of it that's burnt elsewhere. And, of course, for the gas companies in particular, it's a bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card because they can ship off as much as they like and it's not our problem. Yeah. More than 80% of it does go off as liquefied natural gas, so-called, a considerable proportion of that to Japan. And then guess what? The long-term contracts mean that Japan gets it cheap, so they onsell it to Southeast Asia. So they've got a lot of stake in keeping this thing going and make that very clear to the federal government.
Yeah, and we've covered the issue of that the onselling of gas and how it's slowing down the transition to renewables because of the cheap gas that people in Southeast Asia they could be leapfrogging into. Totally renewable technology, but this cheap gas that's coming in is locking them into fossil fuels.
Yes, and the carbon pollution dumping story is part of that because Japan is selling carbon pollution dumping technology to the countries that it is on selling the gas to. So the problem gets worse.
Great. Now, tell us a little bit about the event yesterday. How did it go? From our side, as in from the side of those who are trying to bring a bit of rationality to this fiasco.
Well, look, I mean, I think it was great that then I would, right? So we had about, I'm going to say about 50 people there, and we had, you know, the usual thing, chants, and we had a pretty great flyer. And the main purpose of it, I mean, you can't do much in the way of public awareness with these things, but the main purpose of it was to just get ourselves in front, at least notionally, of the participants and the resources minister, because so far they've been getting away with this scam pretty much scot-free. There hasn't been much pushback. I mean, we in the Beyond Gas Network, of which I'm a member, have been doing something since 2022, trying to talk to federal politicians. And a lot of the federal Labor backbenchers know it's a scam, but they're up against Labor leadership, which is strongly influenced by the gas companies, in particular Madeleine King, who is the resources minister after all. So the best thing about it is we had some pretty brave people, I'm going to say, because I wouldn't have done it, who managed to get inside and hold up things and get right in front of the resources minister while she was speaking. So that is taking the battle to her specifically, which has got to be good. But we've got to do a lot more, obviously. So this was kind of like, from the point of view of a public awareness campaign about this, it was pretty much the toe in the water. And the public awareness campaign is what we are told we need to do, as well as lobbying politicians.
And do you think that there is much public awareness about this issue at the moment? I mean, it's something which seems to come up quite a lot on my various social media feeds, but I suspect that's because I feed them the right sort of information for that.
Yes, I mean, you've got an educated audience, I suspect, about these matters. But I think the answer to that is the old acronym SFA. They know nothing. So I think I'm pretty sure that most people out there in barbecue land think if they hear about it, oh, that's a good idea. You capture the carbon dioxide, you put it back under the ground, all is sweet.
Yeah, indeed.
And so you have to get over that barrier of understanding, which is it's a slightly complicated message, but to call it a con or a scam, which it is, and then get under that, I think you've got a chance with increasing public awareness.
Great. And is there any way that people can find out more, get involved? What would you like listeners to do after hearing about your action yesterday?
Well, look, I was thinking about this. I mean, the problem with us in the Beyond Gas Network, we're a network of community climate groups, and we don't have much presence other than through the individual climate groups. And we don't spend time doing much on our website. So I think the best way of doing it is if people can actually sign up on our website, which is Beyond Gas Network. If you just Google
we'll
Beyond Gas Network
show.
Or one word, it'll come up.
Yep.
And the other way is to send an email to beyondgasnetwork@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. So that's one way. The other groups that were involved in this was Extinction Rebellion, in particular, and they've got a lot of contacts and socials people can get onto.
To me, it seems like there are two call outs that there is, in addition to that, join a local climate action group. And if you've got web skills, maybe get in touch with Beyond Gas and offer to help them update their website.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Thank you. We applied for a small grant last year to help us out with that, but we were not successful. Oh. And we spend all our time sort of lobbying and working, so we don't get much chance of that. But yeah, join a local climate group. There is, if you look at the Climate Action Network Australia website, I believe there's a list of them there that people can go to and get on board that way. Just look up for your local climate group.
Great.
Online.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks very much for your time this morning, Lee, and good luck with the campaign.
You're very welcome, Sonia, and thanks so much for reaching out, as they say.
Pleasure. That was Lee Naunton from the Beyond Gas Network talking to us about an action that they had yesterday for the carbon capture scam protest at a conference that was attended by our resources minister at the federal level, Madeleine King, as well as Cooper's former representative, when it was not called Cooper, Martin Ferguson.
And just worth remembering on the back of that, that 100% renewables is achievable.
Yep.
And what are we doing?
Exactly. There is no rationale for prolonging the life of any fossil fuels. We shouldn't be digging it up.
And putting
it
back
in. And
we
shouldn't be, attempting to put some of it possibly back in with expensive energy intensive technologies. On that happy note.
Thanks, Lee. We'll go to a short break and we'll be back in just a minute.
3CR is about community and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Almost 7:31, Sonia. 3CR, Wednesday morning. Let's have a listen to the wonderful Gillian Welsh, who's currently in Melbourne.
Strange Isabella, never had a coat to wear. Strange Isabella, leaves her perfume in the air. Says, what do I care about the cold? It'll never freeze my tongue. What do I care about the rain? Never rains where I come from. Strange Isabella, never learned to tie shoes. Strange Isabella, she never had the walking blues. She says, what do I care about the cold? It'll never freeze my tongue. What do I care about the rain? It never rains where I come from. Strange Isabella, never had to wash her hands. Strange Isabella, have pity on the working man. Then what do I care about the cold? It'll never freeze my tongue. strange Isabella. Strange Isabella. Strange Isabella.
Gillian Welsh there. That's from an album called The Lost Songs. That song, Strange Isabella, Gillian Welsh, currently in Melbourne with Dave Rawlings. If anyone offers you a ticket to go and see Gillian Welsh and Dave Rawlings, take it. I managed to see them several years ago. It's one of the finest musical things you can hope to see. So enjoy that one. Love Gillian Welsh. It's 35 minutes past seven. We're going to go to an interview we ran on 3CR just earlier this week on Doing Time. This is this is Marissa interviewing Katie Kiss, who is a proud Kanju Berra Widi woman who grew up in central Queensland. And Katie is the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner with the Australian Human Rights Commission. They discuss here in this first part of this interview the establishment of a National Commission for First Peoples Children, which is welcomed by top human rights advocates.
Oh, there's a lot of stuff going on around the country, Marissa. Obviously I want to acknowledge country first.
Of course.
In the land from where we come from. As you said, I'm a proud Kanju Berra Widi woman. So my country is up in Cape York in North Queensland, but I did grow up, born and bred on the lands of the Darrumbal people in Rockhampton. So proud Aboriginal woman. I'm really concerned about the circumstances that we're seeing play out in our communities at the moment. And there's a whole range of things that are going on, right? So I want to acknowledge the Invasion Day rally in Perth, where we saw an alleged device thrown into our community gathering over there, and that now is going through a court proceeding. But the fear that that's raised in our communities and born from racism that we've been exposed to over generations. So we're seeing this escalate on the back of the referendum in particular, the racism that's coming from the back of the Bondi attack. These sorts of attacks are escalating. We saw the camp sovereignty situation play out as well. So racism in our community is going through the roof. It's also being reflected in policies across the country that are affecting, in particular, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. And I come from Queensland, and so we are the first state to introduce adult crime, adult time legislation, which is having a massive impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. We know that our children, through the Closing the Gap targets, are being still removed from their families at unprecedented and inappropriate rates. So there's so much going on for our people and our children and our families at the moment, and we're dealing with so much. And I think, you know, we need to be working together a bit more closely to try to resolve some of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe there's a new bill that's being looked at the moment.
There is. So as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, the National Commission for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People's Bill 2026 was introduced to the Australian Parliament in early February. And that bill sets up the statutory appointment and the office of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People's Commissioner. That was that position has been fought for a long time by our peak organisations like SNAIC, but also our State and Territory Children's Commissioners, and that includes our First Peoples Children's Commissioners in states and territories. And obviously the Human Rights Commission backed that call as well with our National Children's Commissioner at the Human Rights Commission and my position as well, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. So, you know, this will be the first time we've had, and the Commissioner's already sitting in that position with Sue-Ann Hunter doing a great job and Lil Gordon setting that position up initially, but this will be the first time that we have a statutory body that deals specifically with issues that are affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, including from child removal to youth detention, but also more positive initiatives like access to healthcare, access to education, making sure that people have got cultural foundations grounded and children are developmentally accessing their culture to take a positive approach forward in their futures. So this commissioner role is very important. you'll hear some conversation about the fact that it aligns very closely to both my position and the National Children's Commissioner. And we've designed it to make sure that it's operating consistently with the principles that the Australian Human Rights Commission are based on, and that includes human rights principles. So it's been designed like that on purpose, not to double up or duplicate, but to make sure that we're all working towards the same outcomes.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that really needed to be looked at. And this role is the only one at the national level, isn't it?
We have a National Children's Commissioner, who's Deb Sabaris. She's my colleague at the Australian Human Rights Commission. But there's no requirement for that position to be an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person. So under this legislation, this commissioner is required to be of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander background. So not even my position as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner is required to be held by one of our mob.
Wow. It's so important to have First Nations led, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. And, you know, we've seen the work that Lil's done to take this legislation forward, but also being carried now by Sue Ann Hunter, who, you know, played a big role in child safety. She's had a big role in women and children's issues, but she's also played a massive role in the Yarrup Justice Commission, the Truth-Telling Commission in Victoria, and she heard the issues from the Victorian state level, at least, around children's issues and the statistics that we're seeing in those closing the gap outcomes that we keep failing. So, you know, this position is going to be critical in the broader infrastructure to closing the gap, but also into making sure that we are realising the rights of children, that children's voices can be escalated, our children's voices can be escalated. You know, in Queensland, we have 10-year-olds sitting in watch houses for up to 3 weeks at a time. We need to address those systemic and structural discriminatory issues that are impacting our families and our children, and Sue Ann will have a significant role in that.
This show that we run here at 3CR, we look a lot at all this stuff. In particular, we look at Stolen Generation. And one of the things that is a real atrocity is that First Nation kids are being left behind and they're overrepresented in the child protection and youth detention systems. And I find that to be disgraceful conduct by government.
Absolutely. You know, we're seeing governments, state and territory governments, commit to targets under closing the gap to reduce things like youth detention, to reduce out-of-home care and the removal of children from their families and communities, and to make sure that they stay connected to community and culture. But we're seeing state and territory jurisdictions progress legislation that is in direct contradiction to those targets and those commitments that they have signed up to. You know, the thing that concerns myself and my fellow commissioners at the national level is that there is not a lot of national leadership to hold those states and territories accountable to those standards that we have committed to, not just under closing the gap, but in international human rights law. So, for example, the age of criminal responsibility at the international level is 14. We have 10-year-olds in some jurisdictions being put into watch houses, adult watch houses. So we are not in compliance with our international obligations, we're not in compliance with the rights of children, and we're not in compliance with the standards that we want to see as Australians. In the way that we treat all children, but in particular Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children.
And when will this bill be implemented, do you think?
So it was introduced in early February. They've had the debate in the House of Representatives and it's gone to the Senate, is my understanding. So they'll have some conversations in the Senate. They'll work out whether they support it in the Senate or not, and it'll come back down to the House of Representatives to be voted on and then enacted, hopefully. We know that the LNP government have already made their position public around the fact that they won't be supporting this bill, which is disappointing. And both Commissioner Hunter and I sat in on the debate in the House of Representatives when this bill was debated. Some of the commentary that came out of opposition members to the bill was pretty alarming and reminiscent of policies of past practice, which is significantly concerning. Because as you mentioned, you know, we've had those policies that impacted the Stolen Generation, that created the Stolen Generation. We've had a national apology that says we will never do that again. But the policies and practices that we're seeing coming out are absolutely doing that again. And then we have this position, which is about undoing some of that harm and damage that's been done through those policies and practices. And we've got the opposition government saying, no, we're not going to support that. So I'm really concerned about where we're heading. I'm really concerned about the impact of these policies and processes on our kids. And I'm really concerned about the fact that we're setting our communities up to fail. The Prime Minister has made a statement in, you know, Close the Gap week to say that we don't want to keep talking about failure. Well, in order for us to stop talking about failure, we need to stop failing.
Yeah, so they need to put in the new bill to you know, establish you know, good things for First Nations children.
Yeah, positive progress. And so, you know, props to the Labor government for doing this, the Albanese government. They have introduced this bill through Minister Plibersek. She's taken an active role in this, and she's a champion for this legislation. So it's a really positive movement in terms of the Labor government's commitment to closing the gap. This is a positive, tangible outcome to make sure that we've got a commissioner in place that can help facilitate the voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people on issues that affect them. And that's critical to the implementation of, for example, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and Self-Determination. So it's really critical that government supports this. It's a positive bill. If it's enacted, we hopefully will see some change. And Commissioner Hunter, myself, Commissioner Sabaris, the National Children's Commissioner, and even people like Michaela Cronin, who's the Domestic and Family Violence Commissioner, we've all committed to work closely together to make sure that we have a spotlight on children's rights and that we're trying to set foundations that make sure that our kids are moving in the right direction.
Terrific interview there on Doin' Time with Marissa, interviewing Katie Kiss. That was from earlier in the week, part one of an interview. We hope to bring you part two of that interview later this morning. I should say, too, if there's any issues that raises for listeners listening to that, there's numbers you can call for support. Very useful and helpful numbers. 13YARN, which is 139276. There's the Yarning Safe and Strong number, which is 1-800-959-563. That's First Nations support. There's Lifeline, which is 13 11 14. There's also 1-800-RESPECT, which is 1-800-737-732. We'll be back in just a moment.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Now, on the line, we have Tom Sulston, who is Head of Policy at Digital Rights Watch. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Tom.
Good morning.
And you're with both Marty and Sonia here. So you've released a statement about the problems with the aged care assessment. Could you tell us a little bit, first of all, about why you thought it was important to release a statement about the problems with the aged care assessments?
Sure. So yesterday, The Guardian in Australia released an article in which they showed that a thing called the Integrated Assessment Tool, which is used by aged care clinicians to assess a person's needs as they age and work out what they might need from aged care or what they might need from in-home support, that tool has some problems. And chief among those problems is that it's very hard for the human assessors who work in that system to tell it that it's wrong. And so the tool has been making mistakes in the way that it assesses people's aged care needs, typically recommending they don't need as much support as they actually do. And it's very hard or impossible for the workers within the aged care system to say, actually, this is what the person needs. Let's get that to them instead. And so that means that there are people who are going kind of under-assessed for their aged care needs, and we don't have a way of fixing it. And this for us is very problematic because it's, firstly, it's problematic because people should be assessed by a human with whom they can have a conversation about their needs. But it's also problematic because we have a computer system that is making really important decisions about vulnerable people's future and life situation, and they have no right of redress in there. They have no way of having that conversation with the system as a whole. And that's very similar to what happened with RoboDebt.
I was going to say, there is a huge amount of deja vu happening here.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's particularly disheartening to see this happening again when the fallout from RoboDebt was so huge.
Mm. Like leaving and people aside, died.
Yeah, like the impact on kind of individual citizens' lives was enormous.
Care assessment is not an easy process in the first place either. Having had some experience with it, it's just the process in the first place without any shortfall in the way the system works. It's a very
even when it
difficult
works, it's
process.
Still an involved process.
Yeah, it is an involved process. It is difficult, and I think when you're a person kind of navigating, the Department of Health and the aged care system as a whole, you're a very small player in that machine, and you're very disempowered to begin with. And so the way that this computer system is kind of driving you as a human is kind of further disempowering in that already very difficult scenario.
What do you think? I mean, as you're saying, it sounds so similar to what happened with RoboDebt. There's a vulnerable pool of people, a system which is so much larger than the individual is, with complicated and ongoing processes. But so you would think that we wouldn't be making the same costly mistakes again. Why is it that we are unable to learn from what happened with RoboDebt? What are the drivers that you see?
Yeah, and not being inside the Department of Health, I'm not at liberty to say, what decisions led us to this point. But what I think is worth noting is that the Royal Commission into RoboDebt had a load of recommendations that kind of came out at the end of it. And one of those was that processes should be designed with an emphasis on the people they are meant to serve. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty good recommendation, right? Like the public service is there to serve the public. And therefore, systems like Centrelink, systems like the integrated assessment tool for aging, are there to serve people and kind of help them get the support they need. They're not there as systems to, reduce the costs of providing necessary care. And I think that's what has been missed in first the RoboDebt instance and the integrated assessment tool, is that those processes, those computer systems have not been designed to ask the question, how do we make this sure that this person gets everything they need? They're actually implemented to ask the question, how do we make sure we don't spend money?
Yeah.
And sure, we have an aging population. We need to keep an eye on the books and make sure that public money is spent diligently. But it's not as important as making sure our fellow citizens have what they need. And so that rebalancing of the system is what needs to happen. The fact that it hasn't happened again is worrying, because we are going to see more and more decision-making tools and systems rolled out across both the public service and the private sector as AI grows everywhere and gets used to make decisions for people and about people. And unless we get the scaffolding around those systems correct to make sure that we're looked after properly as those systems are doing that work, we're going to see this happen in multiple areas of society, and it's very worrying indeed.
Yes, and seen just recently the calls for, from government saying that they need to be in charge and, running AI in this country because it's going to be worth, trillions of dollars. I suppose it's important to think, where are the priorities? Firstly, looking after the people that need it the most.
Indeed. And I also think that there is a problem with this techno-optimism in thinking that we are going to be able to solve these complicated and complex problems by the use of digital technology, that we don't need that human intervention. We seem to be trying to cut the people out of the equation, not just the people who are whose needs are supposed to be met, but also the people who are in direct contact with those whose needs need to be met. Would you agree with that assessment, Tom?
Yeah, I think if you talk with the CPSU, they will quite happily say that workers in the public service need to be given more authority and autonomy to do their jobs and to do them well. But also there's a fundamental kind of rule of computer system design that kind of came out of IBM in the 1970s, which is that computers can't feel consequences, right? Like they don't understand accountability. That's the thing that exists to a computer. And therefore, it's not right for computers to make management decisions because you can't hold them accountable. And so here we are, the RoboDebt algorithm can't be held accountable for the actions of RoboDebt. It's just an algorithm. Yeah. The same here with the aged care assessment tool. It's just a piece of software. It doesn't have accountability. And so we need to ensure that as we...
Unfortunately, kind of we don't seem to see much accountability at any level of the organisation in terms of RoboDebt. But
yeah, I mean, it took a very long time for the RoboDebt Royal Commission to run through, and I think that the consequences for the kind of main actors and decision makers in that, you're right, have not been felt. But I think that we can at least say the department felt some accountability and was brought to book. It just shouldn't take years for that to happen, and it shouldn't take thousands of people kind of facing harm and, literally death in some circumstances for us to get there.
How long has the aged care assessment tool been operational?
That's a really good question. And I have to confess, I don't know how long it has been running for. Mm. I can say that one thing that has been noted since its operation is that there has been a significant increase in the number of complaints to kind of advocacy organisations working in kind of the aged care space since it was implemented. So obviously we can't say all of those are related to the tool. Many of them are not. They're related to other items. But certainly there has been an uptick in need for those services since the tool was introduced.
It was introduced in November.
Recently?
Fairly recent, yeah, is what it says here.
Okay.
Do you have any recommendations of things that listeners could get on to do to either find out more or to raise awareness over the concerns here?
Yeah, I think it's, the first thing is to be informed, right? So, it's great to listen to 3CR. That's where you come to get informed. So know that there's a thing. If you're supporting, older people going through the system, or maybe you are going through the system yourself, knowing that, the machine is making decisions on your behalf and you may not get input into that through an assessor means that you may need to seek other avenues of redress. And so working out that kind of network of advocacy orgs like the Older Persons Advocacy Network, working out where you can get help and support, recognizing that the system isn't necessarily going to give you the help and support you need. Mm-hmm. I think that is core. And the other one is kind of, building power. As citizens, and especially as older citizens, we are frequently disenfranchised from our government, and we do often feel that we're facing a large wall of bureaucracy. And so building, peer support networks, engaging with those advocacy orgs, building authority, getting angry and haranguing your MP and the department to do better about a system that is meant to provide care and support to vulnerable Australians, like that's core government business. I think it's not unreasonable to say we should probably hold off on spending large amounts of money on submarines until we've got more important things like how do we look after each other in our old age sorted out.
Yeah, so how we look after each other at any stage of life, I think, is a part of the problem that we have here at the moment. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thank you for highlighting this issue, because I think it's just going to get more airtime the further and the longer that this tool is rolled out, especially if people don't start taking advocacy on this issue seriously now.
Thanks very much for having me.
Been a pleasure.
Gee, some good advice there from Tom at the back end of that discussion.
Yes. Because you can. Policy at Digital Rights Watch.
Yes. Because you can. You can feel sometimes when you're dealing with these systems and bureaucracy, you know, that you need to try and understand it yourself. You know, it's not always easy to understand these things. You know, people often probably find themselves jumping through hoops.
And that's people whose important. First language is English.
Of course.
People who, you know, who are quite literate in systems can still find it really difficult to navigate, whereas it should be set up so that even the most vulnerable, most illiterate, English illiterate person is able to navigate the system with ease. Yet we don't have systems that are set up that way. You need to be a professional to be able to navigate, a professional in those systems to be able to navigate them. And they are based upon, as Tom was saying, the idea that it's about saving money rather than saving lives and looking after people.
Always remember to put your hand up and look for some support when you need it. Get some advice. It's always a very good thing. Great to have Tom on speaking with us this morning. We'll be back in just a moment, folks.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
It's a minute and a half past 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning. You're here with myself, Marty, and Sonia. We're going to go to the second part of the interview that we were running earlier this morning. This is Marissa from Doin' Time, fantastic program here on 3CR. Marissa spoke with Katie Kiss from Central Queensland. Katie is the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner with the Australian Human Rights Commission. Here they are discussing the establishment of a National Commission for First Peoples Children, which is something that is welcomed by top human rights advocates.
You were saying at the beginning of this conversation that, you know, all this stuff's been going on with racism and camp sovereignty and what's happened in Perth. Let's hope that none of this bill isn't impacted by racism or racist.
Well, you know, I think whenever there's a conversation about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights, we get the opposition saying that, you know, they're getting more than everybody else. We had a treaty conversation on the weekend where, you know, we talked about the impact of native title debate where Australians were led to believe that we were coming for their backyards, you know. So after the referendum, you know, The Voice, anything to do with Aboriginal affairs, we voted against that. Well, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have specific human rights. We have unique rights that are related to our culture and to our access to who we are as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so we need to be progressing those things. We also have a national anti-racism framework that was commissioned by the federal government in order to eradicate racism. And that's one of the priority reforms under the National Closing the Gap Agreement, to eradicate racism and transform the way government works with our people. So we've got some key targets, we've got some key tools to address some of those things. We now need to enact them and put them into action. And so I've been having conversations with government about picking that national anti-racism framework up. And my colleague, Giri Sivaraman, who's the Race Discrimination Commissioner, he's also been out there banging the drum, trying to get, action on that anti-racism approach. So there's a lot of work we need to do in the Australian community, and the Prime Minister's acknowledged that during the Closing the Gap week, but also in response to the Boorloo Perth attack. So, you know, we're now in a process where we have to be careful about how we progress that. We've got a court case underway. We need to be addressing racism in our country in a very specific, targeted and strategic approach that takes on into account our rights, but also that national anti-racism framework to eradicate racism in our community more broadly.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we need to really understand, I suppose, that this is still a colony, and there's been so much suffering of First Nations people on the missions, and it's really important, isn't it, to look back over history, and that these things are also happening now. So it's really amazing that this new bill will hopefully be established.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we are seeing positive movement from the government's perspective around things like this bill that's going in to protect the rights of our children, but also things like the Yurok Justice Commission and the truth-telling work that's been undertaken there. You know, we started a process in Queensland. We had a Path to Treaty Act that got repealed by the Queensland LNP government. But we've done a lot of work to support truth-telling across the country now. We're starting to build momentum back around that after the referendum. And, you know, we're all still committed to those three pillars of voice, treaty and truth. You know, Aboriginal people can't, and Torres Strait Islander people can't make decisions without having a voice structure to participate in those decisions. We can't end up with agreements that have positive outcomes for our people, like treaties, if the broader Australian community don't understand the history of the country that we live in and the impact that's been had on the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through government policy. And most Australians don't actually know that history, and that came out through the preparation that we did for The Voice. But there's a lot more work to do around civics education and making sure that Australians, more broadly, understand the origins of the country that they live in, the history of the country that they live in, and our collective history going forward now, and how we move together, unified, as a nation that respects each other.
And you're listening to the Doing Time Show. It's approximately 4:46. So what else would you like to say before we actually finish?
I think the other thing, Marissa, that I just wanted to touch on is that the Australian government adopted the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2009. So we're now 16 years since the Australian government made that commitment. That is a blueprint that underpins those targets that are in Closing the Gap. Now, if we didn't have human rights issues in Australia, there'd be no need for Closing the Gap. And I'm now on the second iteration of that since working in the Human Rights Commission. But each of those targets represents a human rights breach.
Yeah.
The remedy to that is the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because it provides a blueprint for addressing every single one of those rights that have been breached under the Closing the Gap agreement. So the government have had a parliamentary inquiry on that. They have six recommendations sitting on the table. It's been 2 years since that inquiry provided that report, and we've had no response from government. So there are a couple of key items. There's a National Human Rights Act that needs to be implemented. There's the implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and there's the implementation of that national anti-racism framework. And seeing those key pillars in place will put us in good stead to address those Closing the Gap targets that continue to go backwards.
You've just explained things so beautifully, Katie, and I'm just you know, I love it. I mean, I love the way you talk about, you know, the laws and the legislation, because I think there simply isn't enough talk about this, is there?
Well, I don't think the broader Australian community understand this, you know, ecosystem that we exist within, but I also don't think that our people know their rights well enough to be able to advocate for them. You know, we hear a lot of talk about truth and treaty and self-determination and land rights and all that sort of stuff, but what does that look like in the sense of dealing with discrimination, addressing racism, closing the gap and making sure that our rights are realised? So I think, you know, we do have tools available to us. We need to work collectively to make sure that the momentum is there to put pressure on government to implement them now. If the Prime Minister is as committed as he says he is to closing the gap, well, we've got the tools there. Start working with us to implement them.
We certainly need to also get the First Nations children out of prison as well.
Absolutely. The last thing we need is our kids in jail. And, you know, we're overrepresented in the adult population. I did my listening tour where I visited three prisons in the Northern Territory, and, you know, it's overwhelming, the number of our people that are in those prisons. That's adults. And then, you know, we know that we're significantly overrepresented in the children youth detention facilities as well. But the other thing that I'm mindful of is the rising and constantly increasing numbers of deaths in custody. And, you know, coming out of the Royal Commission into deaths in custody, we've had more than 620 deaths in custody now since that, plus the 99 that were considered as part of that Royal Commission. No one has ever been held criminally responsible for any of those deaths in custody. So there is work to do there too. And, you know, the thing is with our children and our women in particular, two of the fastest growing populations in the prison area, going into these detention facilities, we set them up for a future that is not looking good for our people. So we're heading back to some of the practices of the old days. And if we're committed to closing the gap, then we need to be working in a different way. And that's what the Closing the Gap transformation approach is about.
We certainly need to build the movement to stop Aboriginal deaths in custody and to stop police investigating police. I mean, look what happened to Lex Watton in Queensland.
Yep. And, you know, Kumanjai Walker, and we've got now Kumanjai White's case underway. And so, and there's a whole lot of people, like I said, 618 that have died in custody since the Royal Commission. So, you know, we've got a lot of work to do in that space. We've been talking to government about some options around dealing with that and making sure that we've got monitoring units in place. Most people wouldn't be aware that under the former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, ATSIC, there was a monitoring unit in ATSIC on the Ricky Dick recommendations. And when ATSIC was dismantled under the Howard government, that unit went with it. Nothing was ever replaced. So, you know, we need monitoring around those recommendations, which most of them have not been addressed, and that goes to the Bringing Them Home report recommendations as well. But we also need, like you're saying, independent investigatory models to make sure that police are not investigating police when there's deaths in custody.
I mean, the recommendations certainly haven't been implemented
for
the Royal Commission.
Either the Royal Commission or the Bringing Them Home report.
Both.
We talked earlier about stolen gens. Only 6% of those recommendations have been implemented.
Wow.
And Ricky Dick, I'm not sure of the percentage on that, but I know a large proportion of them haven't been implemented. But also, you know, things like the criminalisation of public drunkenness. That was a recommendation of the Royal Commission, and we're seeing that now being reintroduced in the Northern Territory. The Dondale Review, the Dondale Royal Commission, you know, they banned the use of spit hoods. We're going back to that in the Northern Territory again. So we're regressing from key positive recommendations that we saw starting to hit the ground and make change in the way that these systems operate and affect our people. But then we see governments come in and regress back to those harmful policies and practices that can destroy our people.
Absolutely. And this show, the Doing Time Show, is committed to honouring the dead. We often do roll call in terms of deaths in custody. And I'd like to also honour Auntie Tanya Day, who died as a result of not having having those laws.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the other thing to understand is that when we're talking about deaths in custody, we're not just talking about deaths in prison. We're talking about deaths in the back of paddy wagons. We're talking about deaths in watch houses. We're talking about being arrested on the street and dying while you're being held down on the ground. So, you know, deaths in custody has a broader connotation than just dying in a prison cell.
You're on 3CR. It's 13 minutes past 8. We want to again thank Marissa from Doing Time for that interview earlier this week. It was where Marissa interviewed Katie Kiss, who is from Central Queensland, a proud Kanju and Biri Widi woman from Central Queensland. Katie is also the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner with the Australian Human Rights Commission. And as we heard there and in the earlier part one of our interview this morning from Doing Time, they discussed the establishment of a National Commission for First Peoples Children, which is welcomed by top human rights advocates. And I'd like to add again that if that interview or some of the subject matter in the interview causes any concerns for any listeners, you can call for support. There's support lines available, including 13YARN, which is 139276. There's also Yarning Safe and Strong, which is 1-800-959-563. There for First Nations support. Lifeline is on 13 11 14. There's also a suicide callback service for support that people can call anytime, 1-300-659-4 6 7, 1-800-RESPECT also. 1-800-RESPECT is 1-800-737-732. And the Kids Helpline, which is available, is 1-800-55-1800. We'll be back in just a moment here on 3CR.
We jail black males in Australia nationally at a rate five times greater than apartheid South Africa jailed black males in 1993. The suicide and self-harm rates are the highest in the world, and the life expectancy gap is the biggest in the first world. You know, Australians don't like hearing the truth about how bad things are, but the more we resolve from it, the longer this is going to continue.
Black fella, white fella, it doesn't matter what you colour.
Mainstream media is not interested in this stuff. It doesn't find space to talk truthfully and deeply about issues that affect all Australians. The only place predominantly you will find that with any real depth is on community radio, and 3CR has been one of the great leaders in that. So if people are wondering where they should spend their hard-earned cash, I would suggest 3CR is a bloody good place to start.
What your name is, we got the hell. Lots of changes, we need more brothers.
I want to thank folks, too, who got involved in the subscriber drive, which has been taking place this month. We love bringing you programs here at 3CR. Value the great listeners we have to all the programs across the whole grid.
And how they can contribute to a great community.
Indeed, yeah. We'll go to a song, I think, Sonia, before we go to our next guest, who is actually... also, a
part
3C
subscriber. Yes.
Sorry, not a subscriber, a presenter.
Yeah. Presenter.
But before we do that, yeah, let's listen to the song. This is Jack Howard's Epic Brass. This is a live track recorded at the Nemo Music Hall in St Kilda, where Jack's going to be playing again in a couple of days. We'll give you some details about that after this track. You're on 3CR.
Sweet, sweet.
Jack Howard's Epic Brass there. Pretty epic. That song recorded live at the MIMO Music Hall and featuring the late Ron Pino. Played that one, Sonia, because Jack Howard's Epic Brass is actually playing at the MIMO Music Hall again on February the 27th.
And
now we're joined by Amy from 3CR's Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. Good morning, Amy.
Hi, how are you going?
Better now. We've got you on the line. How's things at this early hour, 21 minutes past eight with you?
I'm good. I'm here to promote a special broadcast that we have next week here on 3CR at 2 p.m. next Thursday, March the 5th.
Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day, March the 5th.
Yeah,
and it's not the first time it's been talked about here on 3CR. It was talked about last year. It's an annual event. Can you tell us a little bit about, firstly, the Day of Awareness?
Yeah, sure. So Dissociative Identity Disorder, which is formerly known as Multiple Personality Disorder, I'm someone who lives with it. Technically, I'm more of a we, but we'll get into that on the day. It's a day of awareness to raise awareness for disorder because it's incredibly misunderstood and stigmatized. We're always represented as murderers in mainstream media. There's always a murderer in every detective or crime show that has multiple personalities. It's not a personality disorder. It's rooted in dissociation. It's in the spectrum of complex trauma and dissociation. So our Awareness Day broadcast is inclusive of the gamut of complex trauma and dissociation and dissociative disorders. And everyone experiences dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
But dissociative disorders, and we should talk about dissociation and symptoms and things that people experience, which we did last year. But dissociative disorders sit sort of on the more extreme end, and they usually were from what's called complex trauma. And complex trauma is post-traumatic stress disorder from some serious traumas that you've had as a child that were ongoing or multiple.
And can be misdiagnosed, can't they?
So DID or other dissociative disorders are not the most well understood. So this year's theme is navigating medical systems. So I'll be interviewing Kathy Kesselman again from the Blue Knot Foundation to talk about her sort of national perspective on where that's at, and her foundation also provides education on training for professionals on complex trauma and dissociation. She was really fabulous last year. I encourage people to go to 3cr.org.au/DID2025, and you can scroll down and you can find our full interview with Kathy, where we get into the nitty-gritty of what this this topic is, but also the current understanding of it. But this year we're talking about medical systems. So we're going to start with Kathy, and then I'm organizing a series of interviews with just other everyday people living with DID and sharing our experiences of navigating medical systems, whether we're being treated right, whether we think medical professionals that we've encountered understand it.
It's fantastic. What was the response like last year?
It was a good response, actually.
Yep.
We had people actually get in touch, which is exciting. Yep. I think generally some people might wonder why one specific disorder gets an awareness day. First of all, I'm keen to organize. I said I was going to do it last year. I said I was going to do it this year, and I'm still committed to that, which is either a 3CR day of madness or maybe a week of madness, and we do special broadcasts on, like we do with disability, just focusing on mental health, which I think could be really exciting because we have so many shows that could do some amazing angles on that.
That sounds fantastic.
and YDID, simply because it's up there with schizophrenia in terms of stigma and also just so poorly known. It used to be that people did, when it was known as multiple personality disorder, it used to be people didn't believe it existed. And it was very challenging for people living with it. It's come a long way, and it can be shown in brain scans and stuff now, so it's not really a matter of debate anymore. But, it's very poorly understood. But it does affect 3% to 5% of the population, which when you add that to 27 million people here in this continent, yep, that's actually a lot of people.
Yes, it's a very significant number.
And also,
yep,
complex trauma affects... Not specifically complex trauma, but 40% of Australian adults have suffered significant childhood trauma. And there was this famous test called the ACEs test, A-C-E-S, which was designed to show, people could take it online, it's just 10 simple questions, and it's just designed to demonstrate whether, you've had a certain amount of trauma as a childhood. And if you get four or more of those questions right, you fall into the percentile of the population that will live on average 20 years less than your age group. So and it doesn't matter if you're a smoker or anything, you have an extremely higher chance of things like lung cancer and stuff like that. So we are actually a health epidemic that probably should be addressed, those of us who are survivors with complex trauma and other disorders relating to that.
There's some startling numbers there. You actually already, and you just touched on something I was going to ask you about, which is about diagnosis and the fact that it can be diagnosed, and it sounds like from what you've just said, in ways that possibly weren't available not that long ago. So that's a very positive sign for people who need to seek treatment or want to seek treatment, and they can be confident that they're going to get the right diagnosis.
Yeah, and the biggest issue of DID specifically is that it comes with dissociative amnesia. So we lose time and we forget. I am speaking to you as Amy right now, but I have other alters. And if they're in the driver's seat of my mind, I disappear and I don't remember what happened.
Right.
As therapy progresses, we start to bleed into each other. We start to have vivid memories.
Yep.
But it's partly what makes it extremely difficult. And it's not as overt as it is in the TV. It's a system designed to survive a really difficult childhood. So it's not so easy to notice.
You're a champion for making Awareness Day a part of the station on March 5, Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day. Just quickly, while we've got you, Amy, how's Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence going?
Great. This year we've kicked off with a bit of collaboration with Neighbourhood Houses Victoria, doing a lot of coverage on that. I'm going to have Friends of the Earth Sustainable Cities Collective coming on the show, and I'm going to ride buses with them and review bus routes out in the west.
Cool.
And just a lot of other community-based stuff about our cities and suburbs, and also the environment in our cities and suburbs. Yeah.
Great stuff. We're running out of time rapidly here. You have a great day. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. You too have a lovely day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Amy, joining us there.
It's now 8:29. I think that we're going to have to say goodbye without even doing a show rundown
and get
today.
Out of it. Well, we had Amy.
We had Katie Kearse. We had Tom Sulston from Digital Rights Watch.
We had Lee Naunton from Beyond Gas.
So thank you to all of our guests. Thank you to Marissa. And coming up next is Stick Together.
Have a great day.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.